This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to the Radio Book Lounge, where you can put up your feet, rest your eyes, and enjoy a good book. I'm Rabble.ca Books Editor Lisa Rundle, and today in the lounge we'll be listening in on a panel in the fabulously loungy Gladstone Hotel in Toronto's Parkdale neighborhood. The panel took place this November as part of a whirlwind of activity celebrating all that Toronto could be, inspired by the launch of the new Coach House anthology called Utopia. That's U-T-O-P-I-A. The panel features contributors to the book. You'll first hear host Edward Keenan, then Dave Meslin, Heather McLean, Darren O'Donnell, and Adam Vaughn. Political space was the theme. The panel was sponsored by Rabble.ca's Book Lounge and is part of the special book review package on site now at www.rabble.ca/reviews, all about the places we live. We hope you enjoyed the listen.
We're just about ready to start our final panel of the day. It's on political space. Okay. My name is Edward Keenan. I am a contributor to Utopia, and I am the city editor of iWeekly. I'll just introduce the panel that will be discussing political space. Directly to my left is Adam Vaughn. He has been a reporter for Metro Morning and the CBC Evening News and is currently the city reporter for City TV. To his left is Dave Meslin, who everyone calls Mez. He runs the Toronto Public Space Committee, and he's on the cover of this week's issue of iWeekly. had nothing to do with that. Heather McLean just started her PhD exploring the political economy of urban planning at York University and has worked in the field of planning and community development in Botswana, Africa, with a rural development NGO, and in Toronto with Foodshare, GHK Canada, and the City of Toronto's Affordable Housing Program. Darren O'Donnell, at the end of the table, is a playwright, director, and artist, and he is the author of a novel about Toronto, Your Secrets Sleep With Me. So you in the audience probably have, for the most part, not had a chance to read the book yet, but when I was reading the contributions of the people on this panel, it seemed like one of the common themes was accessibility. Adam wrote specifically about making the city physically more accessible to those with disabilities. Dave Meslin has a newsletter, a fantastic 2019 Imagine newsletter from the City of Toronto, in which he talks about sort of local community meetings for setting budget priorities and de-amalgamation, all of it sort of bringing the city closer to the people. Heather writes in the book about what happens often in the city when planning activities and development take place without the consultation of the people who already live in the community, especially in this neighborhood where some people who have done some development here seem to think they're taming the Wild West. No one would have wanted to move out here before, ignoring, of course, the fact that there were already plenty of people living out here. She writes in part about the need to bring more people into the process, and Darren O'Donnell talks about giving children the vote and giving them a seat on city council, and so that's certainly about accessibility. So my first question to the panel is I want to know why this subject of accessibility is so important. It may seem obvious to some of us, but why is that such a such an important theme in sort of building a better city? And we can start at either end or wherever.
I think that there's a myth that the population is apathetic and unintelligent. And I think the reality is that, in fact, people obviously care very much about the city. It's why we're all here. But I think people find it hard to find spaces where they feel that they can make a difference. And because that they're excluded from so many of the processes that affect our lives, because of limits on accessibility, they're not involved. And then that looks like a population that's apathetic.
Right, and then what happens when people are excluded? Like, what changes about the city and the way it develops if people are excluded? Like, I think there's no question that some people are.
Well, then other forces end up dominating the agenda.
Other forces such
tend
as?
Tend to represent the private sector.
Right. People with a commercial interest in certain types of development. Okay. I mean, anybody else?
I raise the issue of gentrification. There's a lot of really interesting critical writing on gentrification right now about cities all over the world. My sister was living on Beaconsfield, and she and Misha Globerman and some of the people living in the area started to look critically at the amount of bars that were happening or coming into this neighborhood. I was just trying to link issues around who's included and who's excluded. When a lot of urban planning dialogue and rhetoric right now is about revitalizing and regenerating neighborhoods, and there's not a lot of talk in there about accessibility, about affordability. So when you make an area interesting and you clean it up, and it might be a good place for consumption for certain people, but what happens is not only are some of the art spaces in the area, they've become too expensive to rent. Not only that, there are a lot of people that require access to the Queen Street Mental Health site. There's a lot of seniors in the area, a lot of low-income residents. So you can imagine if you end up being pushed out, like if you have bipolar disorder, you're dealing with some serious mental health issue, you're supposed to go live out in Rexdale now to make the area a cool area to hang out for a certain group of people. So it's about exclusion, and it really does affect people's lives. And downtown Toronto is becoming more inaccessible to afford to live here. So that's why I raise the issue.
Okay.
I sort of thinking about it, in terms of thinking about accessibility and thinking about particularly with all the talk about all the great sort of events and nights and all the sort of different cultural activity that happens here in Toronto and that is represented by a lot of people in this room. One thing that sort of strikes me about the question of accessibility is it sort of uses a model where the inaccessible is, or the thing that needs to be accessed is sort of in the center or something like that, and then we try to sort of facilitate ways to get in the center, those of us who are concerned about the accessibility of our work and are concerned about sort of homogenous populations that might end up coming to our work. And what my proposal, I guess, and in the book, and then sort of what I've been thinking about these days is just how rather than thinking about it that it needs to be thought of as the people who are in the center need to sort of diffuse themselves and devolve themselves into the periphery in some way, somehow. So that's sort of how I'm thinking about accessibility these days.
Okay.
The piece I wrote about in the book talks about physical accessibility, and I note that there's a 4-foot jump to get on the stage here tonight, and there's no ramp to get into the building, and that's on a very concrete level, to use concrete in its most appropriate phrase. There's a problem with accessibility. I mean, what happens if you are, 75 years old and you want to get in here with a walker? It's a difficult building to access. It's a stage which is cordoned off and kept away from you. That's a bad thing, because some of the finest minds in the city need help walking. That being said, what excited me about Daryl's piece was about the idea of having children to vote. And I guess I'd like to extend that. I think that anybody who pays tax in the city ought to vote. And that includes people that just arrived. I think it includes people visiting the city when an election's on. I think it's that radical. I think if you're here participating and helping to fund the services in the city, you ought to say how your money is going to be spent. And I think that's key to the accessibility issue is how do we let people participate, and how do we get people who participate vote, and how do we let people whose lives are affected by the decisions that government makes vote, and how do we get people who want to vote voting? And that's the key to accessibility. So I'm going to rephrase and reframe this entire conversation. The folks in this room have no trouble creating political space for themselves. Look at the room you're in. Christina Zeidler and the Zeidler family have created space for political dialogue in the city, and we've inhabited it. We don't have a problem. Most of us probably voted in the last 3, 5, 6, 10 elections. We've all voted. There's a problem, though, in the city, and this problem exists in what I call the post-war suburbs, or someone in the Star today called it the inner ring of suburbs. It's the suburbs just below the old parts of the city. Those people are living in a situation which needs our help. And we have to figure out a way, because we've got a fairly healthy environment down here, we have to figure out a way not only to protect these environments, but to start redeveloping those environments. It moves beyond accessibility for people with disabilities. It moves beyond accessibility for people with age questions. It moves beyond accessibility for people with income questions. It's about reinvigorating our sense of citizenship in this city. And if we don't do it very quickly, I can tell you what's going to happen in 10 years. We're going to have more headlines like the ones we had on Friday. The poor are shooting. The poor are armed in the city. And luckily for us, they're shooting each other right now. Unluckily for them, they haven't figured out that the real enemy is perhaps us, who haven't reached out and figured out a way to make places like Lawrence Heights and Driftwood humane, livable places. And that's the challenge that sits in front of the city right now.
Well, that's what I wanted to move on to, actually, next. And it's, I mean, what you've outlined for us what some of the specific effects of sort of excluding people from the process is and overlooking them. And I wonder if anybody else on the panel wants to address that too. Like, what happens to the city when people are excluded? If the people in the suburbs,
we know what happens. They shoot each other. Yeah.
Right.
Now the question is, what are we going to do to stop that?
Right.
And I think
it's also important to point out that when you say what are we going to do, it there's to make a change there. There's also those communities are doing what they're doing, and I think it's about how we figure out how to, like I said, dissolve ourselves into other
helping
geographies.
them help themselves.
Right. Well, it's not just what are we going to do about it. It's what are we going to allow them to do too. And I guess that's the question. Does anybody have the start of an answer?
There's an interesting group of planners and urban designers that started a group called Planning Action a few years ago, and they had they made an excellent deputation about the official plan, and the latest official plan, it's the guiding document for the overarching ideas of how we're going to plan the city over time. The latest official plan literally had 5 different consultation groups or consultation sessions for community input. So basically, there was one space for every 500,000 residents to have their input on how they wanted to shape the official plan. And there were a lot of visioning exercises and consultation exercises with architects and urban designers and a lot of private sector stakeholders. But in terms of public participation to shape the vision of that plan, there wasn't a lot of input. So in terms of like the post-war suburbs and planning, and all throughout the city, you don't really get a lot of input in terms of accessibility, green space, transit from just average people. So that's an example of a lack of, there's a lot of talk about community input, but there aren't, in terms of the processes available, there aren't a lot of places to make input that really affect the city planning.
Right. And what's the effect on the official plan? Like, is it left out the concerns of the people, say in Malvern, the people at risk of people?
The criticism of my planning action was that it had a strong regeneration, revitalization thrust, and again, taking areas and making them more, it's great for small businesses and trying to improve areas, but there was a lack of emphasis on affordable housing. Again, that's a federal and provincial issue, and it's maybe beyond the scope of the city, but still,
Adam's shaking his head. There's
argument that it might be fostering gentrification. It's good if you're an architect or a developer, but community groups were concerned they were excluded.
Well, but I mean, the gentrification only goes so far, right? Like, Riverdale, South Riverdale, Leslieville, Queen and Beaconsfield, they can gentrify, by which we mean poor people move out and rich people move in. But the poor people have to go somewhere, and where they're increasingly going is Scarborough, North York, Etobicoke. And I wonder, it's something that Adam brought up, and it's something that has been mentioned in the earlier panels, but I think it's something that would be really interesting to talk about, is that if you look around the room here, I think you see a fairly great group of people who are really engaged, but a fairly homogenous group also. And I wonder about the people who aren't in this room, who aren't talking about these things, who aren't celebrating the utopia that is, you know, tongue-in-cheek Toronto.
You know, it's funny, a couple of people have asked me to, you know, sign their books today, and I've written in the book, read John Lawrence's article about strip malls out in the outer suburbs, because he's done some really interesting work there. He's identified a vitality that's emerging and that we need to respect. I mean, it's not about having the answers and walking out to the suburbs and delivering the answers. The answers exist there. When you talk to folks in the neighborhood, and I'm going to focus in on Lawrence Heights because I've been sort of watching it carefully for the last little while, and historically I've had a connection there through family. If you ask the people in Lawrence Heights what they want, they know what they want. They want a corner store in their neighborhood. It's about a 19-acre site, and you can't buy bread. You can't buy water or milk or butter or you can't even run out and God forbid, buy, you know, Pop-Tarts, for God's sakes. They know what they want. They know what they need. They have no way of realizing that that energy and making it real. And I think that what we need to do as activists is share our political influence. You know, Dave Meslin, Dave, I call him Dave. I was introduced to him late. He's an extremely effective organizer and extremely effective at articulating community concerns and then finding ways to enact them as policy. Gord Perks, who was around here earlier today, who's running up in the riding of Davenport federally, is an extraordinary organizer. Extraordinary. I mean, if everybody in that riding doesn't vote for him, they should have their head examined. I mean, I'd take Stephen Harper as prime minister if I knew that Mr. Perkins was up there fighting the good fight for us in the city. He's that important to elect. I don't care what party he's running for. He's exceptional. And what we need to do is we need to go up there and use our influence to start making the differences in those neighborhoods, not because we're afraid of the crime. That's secondary. It's because there's a thousand imaginations up there. I mean, talk to Rodrigo Moreno. He's a photographer in the city. He's been doing photo workshops up in Lawrence Heights. He just had an exhibit up in the Board of Education building called Shades. It's coming down to the Lawrence Heights Community Center. It is cutting-edge photography. It's being done by kids with cameras. It's brilliant stuff.
And I think that speaks
He needs our support.
And I think that a lot of us who have, the DIY kind of culture stuff that we're all sort of associated with and that we all promote, I think that that we can get out there with that stuff by thinking about our practice a little bit differently and by, again, I keep coming back to this notion of dissolving our practice out and getting, and for me, I think it rhymes around the nub anyway of youth engagement. And I think that, you know, at a lot of foundations, and the Laidlaw Foundation, for example, is changing its, it's got this program for performing arts, and now they're putting a sort of screen in front of it where all the work that comes to it, which, and they used to fund quite a bit of original work, and that's what their sort of thing has been for the past few years. Like past 20 years, now they're switching it so all that stuff has to engage with youth who are excluded. So excluded youth, which means poor or youth of color. And I think that putting a screen over one's work where one has to have a component that is consciously engaged with excluded youth, whatever that means to you, is a good strategy and to get out there, because youth are going to be adults in, you know, just moments from now. So that is sort of where I'm looking at things.
Under your plan, they become all adults immediately.
What's that?
Under your plan, letting them vote, they become adults immediately.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
Okay, and Dave?
I think that you could also tie this to the issue of amalgamation, because, I mean, most of us here are probably from former city of Toronto, specifically the downtown area. But if this was happening in a pre-amalgamation or in a post-de-amalgamation, then perhaps there'd be 5 books being launched today. Utopia, a U Scarpica, a U Northica, and a U Batopica. And then you'd have more people represented because they wouldn't be living 20 miles away from where it was happening.
Right, Heather?
I was just thinking, when I was in my master's program in urban planning at U of T, I remember Jack Layton saying that one of the flip sides of amalgamation was it was an opportunity to get affordable housing and programs out into the suburbs. So to try to look at it strategically that way. So that is one thing
happened?
Look at all due respect to Jack, the affordable housing and the accessible housing is out there. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it was built the way it was built. And unfortunately, the NDP is the author of a great deal of that housing, high-rise affordable housing. And you know, Deanne Taylor's here, and her essay is also a great read in this book, and she talks about this notion of vertical sprawl. And one of the problems with this notion of embracing affordable housing now and get it all built now is that if we don't build it intelligently, we're going to end up with the stupid situation we have right now in Jane and Finch. Jane and Finch, when Mel Lastman was the first elected mayor, were 4 empty farm fields. Mm-hmm. Okay, they built a lot of affordable housing up there. They built it badly.
Yeah, well,
and this notion that we need to build quick and build fast and build a lot is ramping up a series of solutions which aren't solutions. You talk to folks inside the Let's Build program right now, and they're talking about in the rail lands about selling off chunks of land that have been set aside for public housing, sell it to a private developer at a profit, turn that profit into affordable housing, we're going to get 2 lousy buildings for the price of 1. And the poor people will live in one, and the rich folks will live in another, and we're going to have a great housing program. And I'm sorry, what we're going to have is 2 lousy high-rise buildings that in 20 years will be 2 lousy high-rise buildings full of six and eight families per unit. And we have got to start changing the way we embrace ideology in this city. We've got to start embracing neighborhoods one by one and letting them build themselves incrementally. And if we don't do that, we're going to end up like those other world-class cities.
All right. And I think Heather really wants to respond to that.
No, I just think it's hilarious. There's a reason why I'm in doing a PhD. I worked for Let's Build for a few years, and it was a bureaucratic freak show. And it was really, really frustrating trying to build affordable housing when activist groups are like, you're not building enough, you're not building enough. And the funding that is in housing right now is very, very piecemeal, and all the public-private partnerships. It's really frustrating trying to build housing. But I don't think, what I'm saying is we weren't all excited about let's rush out and build a lot of towers and warehouse poor people. There's a lot of critical people trying to build affordable housing, to give them credit. But what I was just trying to say was just trying to think strategically around amalgamation right now and trying to think about how to plan more accessibly out in the post-war suburbs. And one of the issues is affordability and accessibility. And I was just trying to say that before, you did get a lot of really progressive programs happening in downtown Toronto, and a lot of the suburbs didn't have good affordable housing and community center programs in place. And one way of trying to look at amalgamation was it was an opportunity to open up a way of inserting hopefully more progressive projects out in the suburbs and creating opportunities for dialogue and just trying to deal with it that way rather than you know, like people fought the good fight and what amalgamation happened.
Let me ask Dave a question. You've dealt with a lot of folks at City Hall. I've watched you deal with them. Tell me about the suburban city councillors. I mean, there's a lot of poor people out there, right? You know, if they voted, they'd be the government.
I can't even speak. I can't honestly tell you what I think about them because I don't know who's in the room, and I mean, there wouldn't be appropriate language to use at a public forum.
Well,
but I could say they're useless.
So here's a proposition. Because I liked your article a lot in the book. Here's a proposition. You talk about a post-amalgamation future. Right? Pre-amalgamation, we used to have 107 politicians elected to represent our local needs in the city. Post-amalgamation, we had at one point around 55. Now we have 45.
And they're talking about going to 22.
And they're talking about going to 22, and with a strong mayor system. Right? So a single politician will run the entire city. And that's great. Huh? And Miller signed on to this. And I sat here and listened to him in your articles, Night at the Trampoline Hall, where he talked about cracking open the future of the city. Let's crack it open. Let's go back to 107 politicians. Let's go back to every single neighborhood electing someone to City Hall. Instead of pretending we're a province, let's have a parliament that runs the city. Let's have 107 local politicians running the city. That is an idea. Okay.
Now let's start to think
about it critically. Okay. Now let's start to think about party politics and all the other things that might jump up and hit us in the face. But let's think about Jane Finch electing somebody other than Giorgio Mammoliti or Peter Lapretti. But at the same time, let's also start thinking about electing someone who represents Queen Street to represent Queen Street and not both the Annex and Chinatown and the waterfront. And let's start to really create small political constituencies, and let's create minority parliaments perpetually in the city of Toronto. Let's see where that takes us.
Right. Okay, well, I mean, that's obviously an idea that I think there's a lot of sympathy for in this room. And but let's assume that that's not going to happen overnight. Let's not assume that. Let's work to make that happen. But at the same time as we work to make that happen, let's acknowledge the city that we do live in.
Right. And that is the city we live in. That's the problem.
Yeah, but I mean, the structures place are not changing overnight.
Okay,
how do you get from here to there?
Okay,
that's the question.
That's fair enough.
People could run on that as a platform. I mean, Montreal just went through a de-amalgamation process successfully. And certain cities that were amalgamated voted themselves out. So we could have a separatist movement within Toronto.
A city block party.
And then have the equivalent of what the block is doing.
The city
block. Toronto. Get elected. Yeah.
The city block party. Think about it. The city block party. The blocks run the city, not City Hall running the blocks. It's simple. I'm with you.
All right.
I'm voting for Dave for mayor. Mez for mayor.
So will Adam and Mez be signing up candidates after the meeting, I guess,
if people are
interested?
Let's go forward.
Actually, we'll be signing up candidates.
No, but I mean, we're joking about this, but I think this is the fun. And Daryl's idea of getting kids to vote is at the root of this thing, right? We have to redefine citizenship in this modern world. It is not about property rights. It is not about artificial age barriers that all of a sudden at 17 and a half, you're not allowed to vote, but at 18 and a half, you are. I mean, that's just nuts. It just, it's an accident of when, you know, if I was a December baby, God damn it, I'd be pissed off. You know, I mean, you know. 18's too young. There you go. There you go. Yeah, you have to be 89 to vote. But here's the idea. We have to expand the definition of citizenship, and then we have to define what citizens do at City Hall. And part of what they do is that they run the place, and that's the first order of business.
And there was a billboard campaign earlier this year by Nike, and all this, the slogan was, "Who runs this town?" And I think that was a really good question that they put forward.
Right.
Obviously, they do. I don't have any billboards up. But there's some also, like, I mean, I think there's more concrete short-term solutions to ways to make City Hall more accessible,
right,
now.
Which is what I want to work on.
We're not
going to
elect our slate at least until November 13th, 2006.
Right, so between now and November, that's the next phase I want to talk about. Other than reforming the system, which is clearly an important priority, and Adam Vaughn will be probably running for council on that platform, and Dave Mezen will be running for mayor. Other than that, what can people, not just in this room, but in the suburbs all across the city, like, how can you make the city more responsive to you? I want to get some pragmatics into this, because I think there's a lot of knowledge on this panel about how to make the city work for us.
I mean, I'm wondering if, I mean, in terms of accessibility, and I think one of the sort of things that's most important, and I keep wanting to come back to the people in this room who are doing the stuff that they're doing, and I think that, I mean, one thing that we need is a sort of frank evaluation of our own even social circles and how those are composed and comprised and how those work, because that's where there's a fair amount of exclusivity, and that's where kind of that exclusivity starts. I mean, I can't really talk about the sort of like city planning level of things, but on that level, I think that there needs to be concerted efforts to do something in our own lives and in our own practice where those things are addressed, and how that is, I'm not sure. I'm talking about youth and excluded youth, and I think that that's a good place to start, but I think ourselves and our own practice is probably the best place to start in how we make the work we make.
Right. And Heather, in your essay in the book, you talk about, and it's not necessarily a happy story, but you do talk about how one group of residents in this neighborhood sort of took their concerns to City Hall and got organized.
The organization, it's a group that started to take on different commercial developers trying to say, wait a minute, can we be involved in this process? This community is changing really quickly with a lot of different types of bar development. They're not anti-bar. They like bars. They go to bars. But do you need to have 7 open in 1 year or whatever on one block?
Right.
So they were they're looking at ways of trying to get community involvement more into the process.
And I guess the question is, what are those ways?
Pardon me?
What are those ways to get? You said they're looking at ways to get more
community involvement. They've been waiting around in a lot of bureaucracy, both provincial alcohol policy board stuff as well as city planning. They're trying to make linkages and look for little loopholes, and that's the frustration with the process. They're not finding very clear ways of intervening. So, with stepping back and talking about this, we're talking about de-amalgamation. Part of what's happened with amalgamation is there's been also a scaling back of community-based planning opportunities. So one way would be if a group like the one that started here that I write about, Quebra, if they can link in more maybe with, in this area, St. Christopher House, and try to work with other stakeholders and try to work towards doing more community-based planning. I guess throughout the city, groups are going to have to try to do it in an ad hoc way, try to come up with ways with collaborating with other groups and create that kind of community-based planning process. It used to be more institutionalized, but it doesn't exist right now, and hopefully that's something we can work towards in the future, and in the meantime, try to do that in a grassroots, piecemeal way.
Okay, speaking of the grassroots, Mez, you've had a lot of success. You may have had some frustrations too, but you've had a lot of success pushing your your ideas at City Hall and getting things accomplished and cutting through the bureaucracy. Is there any like practical advice that comes out of that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, it worked because there were so many people who got involved, and what that proved is that there are people who are willing to get involved and are willing to invest time and energy to make a difference in their community when a space is created for them and they're know how to get it. Like, let's go back to Nike, for example. Nike knows in order to sell their shoes, they have to put up the billboards, promote their shoes, and also have it accessible. I mean, if you didn't know where to get Nike, if you had to go to their factory and had never heard of Nike, you probably wouldn't be buying their shoes. So I think the city has to make more of an effort to make democracy accessible. Right. And like a great example is that most of the meetings that are designed for public participation are in the middle of the day when everyone's working. So the private sector that's there for the development or for the billboard, they have lawyers there, they have their own staff there, their CEO is there, and they make their speeches. And then the community is asked, okay, does anyone here want to speak from the community? And no one's there because they're at work. So you've got a total like imbalance of power in these meetings. They have to have evening public meetings.
Right. And now part of your process in your fight against billboards has been to have, you've got, like you say, a big group of people, and you've got some people who may be available at the time when the meetings are happening. So you've sent people there to show up and to oppose them.
With such a small handful of people, Allison's in the room from the Public Space Committee. She's coordinating that campaign right now. And what she does, there's these things called variances, where if you want to get a billboard put up that's illegal, it's too big, it goes to these meetings I'm talking about. I assume the same thing's happening with developments, where things are just being rubber stamped because no one's there to make a deputation. So Allison goes or gets someone else to go, and one person goes and makes a short speech, and they win because they're taking advantage of a space. But, I mean, there has to be day meetings and evening meetings. There should be tons of meetings. And if there aren't enough time for the councillors to go to all these meetings, then, again, that goes back to perhaps amalgamation. And what Adam was saying, you can't represent 40,000 people.
Well,
There's no way to do that.
If you had 107 politicians, you could have day and night meetings. You could trade off. And I've thought about the idea a bit. You know, if you broke each ward down into four councillors, and then you added for each community council from the old municipality sort of generalists that were elected for constituencies that were selected prior to the election. For example, up in Jane Finch and up in Driftwood and in all the neighborhoods around the intersection of Jane and Finch, if right now what you said is our number one issue is youth unemployment, we're going to elect somebody as a vote on council to represent the constituency to get youth employed up there. And they got to choose that constituency, and you had to run to fulfill that constituency. It wasn't set by the general city. It was set locally. So you'd end up with five councillors representing that area. And then coming out of that, you ended up with and this is getting, sorry if I bore you with constitutional discussions, but the idea is to start to fracture the constituencies and create multiple representations. And in creating multiple representations, you can have meetings going around the clock if you want, but at the same time, you have a wider group of people that are in charge of consensus. And that, I think, will create the more humane approach. And that creates the access points, whether it's, you know, maybe the kids in the city get to elect two city councillors. Who knows? I mean, you know, taking into account the worry that some might have about young people voting. On the other hand, I think that what you start to do is start to create micro constituencies, and out of that you create a macro parliament. And that, I think, is part of the process for redefining how the city works. On issues around development, I think it's the issue that's confronting the city right now. How do you squeeze a million more people into the city? And I think the first thing you have to start thinking about is stop this million people into the city and start thinking about how do you squeeze 250,000 more households in. Let's just ramp the numbers down a bit and make them more manageable. 250,000 households means that we stop building one-bedroom apartments and we start building three-bedroom apartments. I think that's a very simple way of starting to do it. Because when you start to do that, then you also have to start worrying about schools and parks and all the things that make the city wonderful. And I think we need to start redefining the way the numbers are being dealt to us, and that is how you create better access.
There you have it. We hope you've enjoyed your visit to the Radio Book Lounge. And if you just can't get enough books, be sure to visit www.rabble.ca/lounge, where you'll find a Left at Your Door online bookstore, perfect for the lazy yet ethical shopper, an online book club, book events, book reviews, and more. Until next time, have fun between those covers. This has been a Radio Book Lounge podcast, part of the Rabble Podcast Network.